Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Well, here's the kind of news day it has been on the defendant Trump beat. Our first guest tonight, former federal prosecutor Andrew Weissman, who is always judicious and reluctant to make predictions, had read and heard enough by the middle of the afternoon. And at 3:36 p.m., Andrew Weissman tweeted a zillion stories about Trump case, but bottom line is he is getting charged and it will be in D.C. and this week. Open issues are whether others may be charged and whether they will be in D.C. or Florida. Andrew Weissman's tweet came after news broke that Donald Trump's criminal defense lawyers went to the Justice Department headquarters in Washington, D.C. today for a meeting this morning that included Special Prosecutor Jack Smith. In the meeting, Trump lawyers James Trustee, John Rowley, and Lindsey Halligan had the opportunity to, quote, make their case that the government should not charge the former president in connection with his possession of classified documents after leaving office, according to people familiar with the matter. The Trump lawyers were seen leaving the building at 11:50 a.m., about 2 hours after they entered the Justice Department for that meeting. Just over 25 minutes later, possibly, maybe probably, after hearing how the meeting went from his lawyers, Donald Trump posted on social media, "How can the Department of Justice possibly charge me, who did nothing wrong?" That's how defendant Trump's morning went. And then this afternoon, news broke that the swimming pool at Mar-a-Lago had been drained and in the process created a flood that may have damaged possible evidence in the documents case. The New York Times reported this afternoon prosecutors are also interested in an incident from October in which a worker drained a pool at Mar-a-Lago causing water damage in a room that contained computer servers that held digital logs for the compound security cameras, according to a person familiar with the matter. And today's news comes after a weekend report in the New York Times that the notes from Donald Trump's first criminal defense lawyer in the documents case, which a judge ordered handed over to prosecutors, were not just notes. They were transcripts of audio recordings made by the lawyer Evan Corcoran. The Times reports, after pleasantries, according to a description of the recorded notes, Mr. Trump asked Mr. Corcoran if he had to comply with the subpoena. Mr. Corcoran told him that he did. Leading off our discussion tonight is Andrew Weissman, former FBI general counsel and former chief of the criminal division in the Eastern District of New York. He is professor of practice at NYU Law School. And with us in the Washington studio is Neil Katyal, former acting U.S. Solicitor General. They are both MSNBC legal analysts. Neil, Andrew's already on record here in this program with his tweet, which he can explain in a moment. Where do you think it stands tonight?
I agree with Andrew up to a part. I mean, I think everything he said was right, that I think that Donald Trump is going to be indicted. I think he's going to be indicted soon. I don't know that it'll be this week. And I agree with Andrew that the open questions are what those charges will be and whether others will be indicted and if those indictments will be in D.C. or in Florida. I think all of them will be in D.C. at the end of the day, if there are others like Walt Nuda, who was Trump's aide and the like. But I think the essence of what Andrew says is right. Donald Trump flagrantly violated the law, even before the latest revelations. Months ago, it was Bill Barr, Lawrence, who said this case is an obvious, clear, present threat to Donald Trump because it looks criminal. And every revelation since, from the swimming pool today to the dress rehearsals for the documents last week that were moved around to the Iran tape about the classified information that came out last week, every single thing furthers the narrative that Donald Trump committed these crimes and then obstructed the investigation into it afterwards. So, like always, I agree with Andrew.
Andrew, why this week? Why do you expect indictments this week?
I think that's based on a number of things, but If you think about what we saw in the Manhattan case, we were looking to see that defense lawyers were given an opportunity to be heard. That's really the thing that you do in a case like this at the final stage. And we saw the defense lawyers going in today to make their final pitch about why there should not be charges. You know, it is conceivable that that could prevail, but I think, meaning that it is theoretically a possibility, but I just think in this case, knowing Jack Smith and his team and the people hearing the appeal, that it's extremely unlikely that they would be hearing something that would lead them to conclude that there should be no charges. So this is sort of the thing you do at the very end. I also think that there is internal pressure, even if they're not sort of admitting it to themselves, that this is a case that needs to be brought, that the American public needs to know whether this happened or not, and it needs to be brought to trial. So this is just not one where you want to dilly-dally. And Jack Smith, remember, inherited this case from DOJ. He's not been on the job all that long and has really sort of put his foot to the pedal in bringing this case. I guess the only other point I'd like to make is, unlike the Manhattan case, where a lot of people have talked about whether Trump would be treated differently if his name were not Trump, here, in a case involving classified documents, it would be a violation of the rule of law if Donald Trump were not charged based on all the facts we know. Just last week, a former Army lieutenant colonel was sentenced to 3 years in jail by a Florida federal judge for doing something far less than what I anticipate Donald Trump is going to be charged with. So to not charge him, it would really be the antithesis of the rule of law. That's something that Jack Smith knows darn well from his career at the state and federal level and at the international level. And it's certainly something that the people at DOJ are hearing the appeal know about the rule of law and it needing to apply regardless of what the former position is of Donald Trump.
Neil, so this story about draining the pool and flooding, possibly destroying, harming evidence in the case. Assuming there was some criminal intent in that and assuming that became a chargeable offense, wouldn't that be something that might be charged in Florida since the totality of that crime, if it is one, occurred in Florida?
Well, Lawrence, if the news reports are to be believed, it looks like Donald Trump is better at draining the pool than he is at draining the swamp. I think there's two things about this pool episode. One, there could be an innocuous explanation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, with Trump, most things that look innocuous aren't, and there's very few that even looks innocuous, but, you know, there's the possibility there. And then second, you're absolutely right that this all occurred in Florida, but that doesn't make venue for the criminal charge reside only in Florida. The overall criminal case is based on one kind of central set of facts, him mishandling classified information and then lying about it and obstructing the investigation afterwards. That took place both in D.C. and Florida. Prosecutors will have their pick of where to indict this entire ball of wax, and they don't have to separate it. So part of it's in Florida, part of it's in D.C. I suspect all of it will be in Washington, D.C. There was an argument up until a couple of weeks ago that maybe Florida was the relevant place. But then you had Donald Trump doing what he always does, puts his foot in his mouth on national TV in the CNN town hall and says, I made these decisions in Washington, D.C. Prosecutors must have been smiling when he said that and said, yep, that's where you made the decision. That's where the case is going to be indicted.
All right. Please be around and available this week. Andrew Weissman and Neil Katyal, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We may be seeing a lot of each other this week. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
See you soon.
Thank you. Well, here is a White House photograph of President Biden, White House Chief of Staff Jeff Zients, meeting with the White House negotiating team in the middle of the very tense and hugely important debt ceiling negotiations. The Biden negotiating team will join us next in the room where it happened. No president or Speaker of the House can ever devote themselves full time to legislative negotiations, even on something as important as the debt ceiling. They have to assign negotiating teams to go at it nonstop. Speaker Kevin McCarthy made an unusual choice. He did not send in the chairman of the relevant committees involved in the negotiation. The speaker instead chose Republican Congressman Garrett Graves of Louisiana and Patrick Henry of North Carolina, McHenry of North Carolina, to negotiate with the White House. President Biden picked the most capable and experienced budget and debt ceiling negotiating team Washington has ever seen. Steve Ricchetti, counselor to the president, has been doing this for 30 years. In 1993, when I was the chief of staff of the Senate Finance Committee with jurisdiction over the debt ceiling and many other things, Steve Ricchetti was working in the White House for President Bill Clinton, where he specialized in dealing with the United States Senate for the president. You couldn't find anyone in the Senate, Democrat or Republican, who didn't like and respect Steve Ricchetti. Shalonda Young is the budget expert in President Biden's cabinet. She was confirmed by the Senate as the director of the Office of Management and Budget with 61 votes, which included the support of Republican senators who had come to admire her in her work as the chief of staff of the House Appropriations Committee, which is one of the only committees in the House that has a long history of bipartisan legislating. No one in the debt ceiling negotiation knew more about the details of the budget of the United States of America than Shalonda Young. In the history of the White House, there is no bond between the president and someone working in the White House quite like the relationship between President Biden and Louisa Terrell, the White House Director of Legislative Affairs. He was just my friend's dad. That's who Joe Biden was to Louisa Terrell when she was a kindergarten student in Delaware in the same classroom with Beau Biden. Today, I met with the Biden negotiating team in the room where it happened. OMB Director Shalonda Young's conference room contains photographs of all of her predecessors, none of whom ever had as difficult and risky a negotiation as the one the Biden team successfully concluded last week. We are sitting here on June 5th. Which was to be the day in history when the United States of America defaults for the very first time. So on this day, on the other side of the White House campus, the Treasury Secretary and everyone in that building would be in something as close to panic as has ever occurred in that building, as we would be watching a stock market crash like we've never seen before, the first day of what would surely be a recession going into a depression, possibly in the United States, followed by a worldwide depression. We're not covering that story today, thanks to you, because you got this job done on something that for people like me who have a little bit of experience with it, had many, many days of thinking that this was impossible, that these two forces couldn't come together and get an agreement. When did you know that you had an agreement?
Well, I said, I think we thought we could the whole time.
Was there ever a day where you thought, I don't know if we get this?
Well, I certainly think there were hours where we thought we were a little choppier, or maybe the disagreements were going to be too severe. But I think we believed we would get to a deal
at the same time.
They certainly did.
Right.
And we worked through it.
So is there a day where Steve is more optimistic than you are, and then you just think this is hopeless?
Yes.
I wouldn't say day. It was definitely hour by hour.
Yeah.
It was part of it. And look, everything that you just started with, the stakes were very, very high. And a default would have been catastrophic for the economy, for the people we cared the most about, for middle-class families, for working families, for people in need. And so I think uppermost in our minds the entire time was, we really do need to find a way to get this done and to protect and to prioritize the things that the president had put front and center from the time that he had campaigned.
So there was a moment in the Oval Office that was the cameras were there, and the president's said with Kevin McCarthy, we agree that we will not go into default. And that's really all they said. But it sounded like a lot to me at that moment. Was it true at that moment? Were you confident at that moment that those, that's really where we were, that there would not be a default?
What do you think?
I mean, I think it would demonstrated sort of the goodwill that was there, the commitment that was there to really start working together. And I do think that it was the way that the president sort of looked him in the eye and said, okay, we're going to do this thing together. And I think that that was an important table setting in some ways for that next stage of the negotiation. There were never guarantees, but I do think there was a way that it kind of solidified or really set the table. That was, I take your point. I think it was significant in that way.
You, having come from the House of Representatives, have the closest, most recent experience in the building working with these people who you were going to have to come to an agreement with. And they, and the differences between Democrats and Republicans in the House of Representatives are as drastic as they've ever been in our history. So you come up here into the administration, it would seem to me, with a lot of doubt about the ability to do anything with Republicans.
Not really. The House is the Wild Wild West, but these two know that I love it, as lots of Senate experience surrounding me. A lot of that looked familiar. The speechifying, the things, we ignored that. People have to say what they have to say. But remember, I worked on the Appropriations Committee. Always kind of has to work.
Yeah.
No one outside of the room thinks it's going to work. Then it always magically works. So I never had the luxury of working in an environment that was, we had a chance to fail. We had to do it. Meaning we found the middle ground that no one else thought was possible. And with the president's leadership, knowing what was at stake, this was pretty easy to say we can have a bad morning, but we had to get back on it the next day or the next day. And look, everyone has ebbs and flows, every one of these. I couldn't tell you how would it end it. Just that you saw that moment switch with the speaker. You saw, while you don't pay attention to everyday remarks, you did feel a moment shift. There where you saw the willingness to come to a deal.
And I'll tell you, Lawrence, right from the start, really, the bipartisan respect that people have for Shalonda out of the gate and how to solve some of the kind of trickier, more technical issues with respect to appropriating and how to get this done.
You had interesting bonds with both of the Republican negotiators, Congressman Garrett Graves, your congressman from your home district in Louisiana, Congressman Patrick McHenry, who, according to one story I saw, you and Congressman McHenry both had daycare issues that had to be dealt with at the same time.
He did not mind calling me on his way to drop off because he knew he would also hear my child screaming. And we could both ignore that and keep talking and not have to worry about explaining that to the other person. Patrick always has to outdo me. He has three. And we usually talked when he dropped the two oldest off and had the little one in the car for daycare drop off. But that kind of matters. I knew if one of us was having a bad Saturday morning, it's probably not the people in this room. It's probably because some child threw something down someplace they weren't supposed to. And I need to give it a minute because we all need a minute sometimes trying to get out of the house with toddlers. So to have that bond and relationship was just, you know, we're all humans at the end of the day. And we saw each other as that. And it's always helpful to get to know people on kind of a cellular level and know what they have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. But still, no matter how friendly you are, behind each negotiator is a couple of hundred votes in the House of Representatives. I've certainly in the past was in negotiations with people I was very, very friendly with, but I knew they can never vote for this. It's impossible. So how do you figure out where the votes are? Because that's one of your jobs all the time, every day, is how many votes are there in this provision? How many do we lose if we go with this provision? If we can shave it this direction, do we pick up a dozen? How were you able to... You must have been constantly juggling vote counts in your head.
It is true. I would say it was like Steve and I had a nightly activity where we were just doing exactly that. It was always whipping about where we thought, where would we lose Democrats if this was weighted, if it just went a little bit over to the right or to the left, how would we hold? And so it was one thing that we were sort of doing all the time. I think it was also two other pieces were we had to keep in touch with leadership, right? So that piece about really talking to Leader Jeffries, really talking to Leader Schumer too, that was a big piece of this. And then I think in particular, there was a great way that Steve, during some of the negotiations, was really making it plain that just as much as the speaker needed to be thinking about his side, that we needed to be thinking about our side. So it wasn't, was something we were doing sort of late at night, but it was also something that kind of came into the negotiations at certain points where we really said, this is a math exercise. At the end of the day, this is math, and we would have...
That's exactly it.
Right? It was very candid.
More than the president's done this for, you know, his entire career. This is his superpower. He really does know how to negotiate what the considerations are that have to be balanced so that you can secure votes on both sides and, you know, really establish a framework that we could negotiate within that made a difference so that we could get this done. I mean, that's really where it begins and ends. You've talked about this over and over on your show for the last week, but I don't think there's ever been a president with this much legislative sagacity and the patience to allow the process to work its way through.
What was the most difficult part of doing this deal? I'm going to ask that of each of you, and you might all agree or you might have different views of what that is.
Well, I got one for you.
Yeah, you start.
I've done a lot of these. I've never been a parent
yes.
during any of them. I waited until a little later in life to do that.
Did you have a nice weekend with Charlie this weekend?
No, she decided to have a fever this weekend, so I cannot complain. She gave me an entire debt negotiation and budget rollout without an illness. But seriously, like just like people go to work in this country every day, and kids get sick, and they either have leave or they don't, like... It makes it real, and I've never had to do one of these. And they know the juggle, the parents flying in to help out, the best friends flying in to help out. So none of us do the village it took in this building and the partners who we came in, checked with, did different aspects with, to family members who sacrificed time and effort and came in to help out. I mean... I just think about the sheer number of hours in my family who backfilled so that I was able to help out in my way. It was just really striking. I was like, why is this time so hard? It's like, ah, you have a toddler. That's why this one is so hard. These things, their failure was not an option. So I always felt confident we would come to a deal. The process was an intense one, mostly just me personally. Trying to parent through it, and that was interesting.
Lawrence, the toughest dimension to this is this time element, where we you really knew that we needed by the first week of June to have made real progress in getting this thing done, and this sensitivity that we needed to have embedded in this negotiating strategy, so that the bottom didn't fall out of either end of this negotiation. We couldn't do it without a decent number of Republicans voting for it. And we needed to be confident that Democrats could support it as well. And the president said that, you know, he really wanted at the center of this to be, you know, support from his party for what we were doing here. And that, I think, as we look back on it, is just a very, very important, and I think a piece of this that we're we're proud of, and I think the president just said was essential for doing it. We got a lot of support in our party for a, you know, a tough and I think a fair negotiation and a result. And folks in our party supported it, and there was enough support on the Republican side as well that it was a true bipartisan accomplishment.
Well, the election forced that. Once the Republicans won the House of Representatives, there is absolutely no choice but negotiating with the Republican House of Representatives on this.
Look, you can, you know, we're in divided government. And this is about as reasonable of an agreement as one can expect from divided government. I've said this many times. They have ideas. They control the House. We have to listen to those. Now, you also don't have to compromise your values and find that middle ground. And I think to Steve's point, look at the vote.
Yeah.
I think that is validation that what the president directed us to do, that it was a success. 76% of House Democratic Caucus, 70% of Republican conference voting for it. You always look at the whole because you can get into the nitty gritty of each piece. And you have to remember to step back when you get to Louisa's point of looking at the votes, like these issues get complicated. You can't just get in your silo and you're nervous until you see the vote count go up. But I think both in the House and Senate, that was validation. We reached that middle ground, that elusive middle ground in divided government.
Does the vote count, which shows more Democrats voting for it than Republicans voting for it, define it as a Democratic win?
Look, I mean, I would say they really got behind the president's vision. I think it's a demonstrates that the Democrats trust the president, knew he came to this with good intentions, and like the years of experience and the kind of, and Shalonda and Steve coming to the table with those kind of folks. And I think it's a testament to that. And I think the other thing is there were just key pieces that we had been in deep, loving partnership with Democrats for the last session to pass terrific things. And we protected that. And that part of that is Democrats are going home and they're talking about the bridges, they're talking about the broadband, they're talking about the pieces. And to know that those were off the table, I think was another way that the Democrats really looked at this White House and this president and said, I trust you, you kept your word, and the things that we worked on together are not part of that bill. And I think that meant something
to them. The signature accomplishments of our first 2 years in the presidency were protected in this, and that was essential.
Well, you know, Democrats, some Democratic voters out there hear this and they say, you're talking about what they didn't take away from you. Can you tell us what you got for us in this?
I think a variety of things. Number one, 2 years of extension on the debt ceiling, which was as consequential a thing as you could possibly have on the table, and which we secured in a parallel track with our negotiation on how to approach spending. And then again, Shalonda did an unbelievably good job of negotiating with respect to, in particular, the spending provisions in this to make sure that the priorities of the president were protected in this while we were negotiating it, as you know, on the table. They had 10 years of caps that were on the table. They had, they had intended to eliminate the clean energy provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act. They had our student debt initiative on the table across the board. And I think we negotiated successfully inside of these agreements with respect to the SNAP reform to help protect more people, to have exemptions, which protected the homeless and veterans. And in with respect to veterans in particular, I think this was a very sound bill.
After this break, the Biden negotiating team will explain the details of the work requirements for food assistance that Republicans insisted on and that the Biden team designed in such a way as to actually increase the number of people who will receive food assistance. And they'll tell us how the president kept his hand in the negotiations even while he was traveling around the world. That's next.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Can we talk about a little bit about the details of the work requirements for the food security program, for the additional people, the new people who will be subject to work requirements? How will those work requirements work? What does it actually mean to a recipient?
So, as you know, typically already in law for SNAP, let's use that. Work requirements are in the program already for those who are 18 to 49 who are recipients. This bill would add that age up to 54. First, we should say all of this sunsets in 2030 because it's appropriate for Congress to look at this to see if this works. But the big thing that we pushed on, because the president had a very clear statement to us, to Republicans, he was not going to have to increase poverty through this bill. So what were we able to do to help soften the provisions? Remember where Republicans started? It was to add exemptions to these work requirements for those who are homeless, those who are veterans, and those who are foster youth aged out to 24. And what we've seen through outside analysis, Congressional Budget Office, that those who are now covered under these work requirements through these exemptions versus who will be added are basically a wash. So to the president's goal of not increasing poverty, we've met that. Not our analysis, but the Congressional Budget Office has shown that. And that's one of the things when you look at an overall agreement, ensuring that where Republicans started, where a million people would have been kicked off of some of these programs, that we were able to neutralize that, ensure that the same number who will now be required, we offset that through these exemptions.
The work requirement, let's just be a little bit specific about it for someone out there who's on this program, and they're living in a community that in some location where they're just thinking, there is no job. I'm not going to be able to find a job. Am I going to lose my food security?
So one thing that states have available to them, and by the way, in negotiations, our Republican friends who did not put this in their bill they passed, did come and say, and I think this is public record, they wanted to take away the state's ability to waive these requirements in places with high unemployment, which we thought was just not great policy. Frankly, you know, I don't like to say red lines, but as close to a non-starter as we were going to have. Those waivers are still in place for states to utilize. But certainly our Republican colleagues wanted that to remove those waivers. We were able to protect that.
I'm going to ask you about your boss, Kevin McCarthy. Here's how Kevin McCarthy described Joe Biden in these negotiations. Very professional, very smart, very tough at the same time. How would you describe Joe Biden in these negotiations?
The president has a great understanding of the pace on the ball. So I would say he was enormously patient with us, and it was very fluid, right? We were in and out with him in his office in the morning, calls at night. So it felt very, you'd have this very long day, and then either on the front end or on the back end, we're going back and forth with the president. But I think the thing that I appreciated both as, you know, you're just like a staffer gal. You're just like hoping it goes okay. And he is incredibly patient with the status, gives good all these steers and advice, knows everything. But his kind of understanding of how there's a pace to all of this, I think, is just enormously, just on a human level, and also giving us tremendous advice as we go through. But that's the thing to me that in
and
part...
And she was intimately involved in every decision
turn.
We made.
Yeah.
We were talking to him from Japan, you know, multiple times a day, 4 o'clock in the morning here, midnight over there to him. And so he was involved in every aspect of what we were doing. He gave us direction about every item. Yeah. We knew where the lines were being drawn from his perspective. And he also understood, I think, better than anyone, because of his experience in this, mm-hmm. where we needed to provide a little space for Republicans to find their way to this as well.
Now, there are a couple of things that always bring home for the president, one who's known him the least amount of time. remember his experience with foreign relations. He's at G7 and a part of this, the backdrop. Hearing what the global reaction is, like hearing him retail, like everyone following everything happening with our domestic conversations.
Couldn't have been more immediate.
Could not have been more immediate. And he gets the stakes of all that. He is having these conversations with world leaders who are following all this. He brings that back to us so we understand the stakes. There are very few presidents with the foreign policy chops of Joe Biden, and hearing how our domestic framework and politics and policies really comes to bear on these global stages is just something we also needed to hear, and he imparted that to us. The other thing is caring.
Yeah.
I also had to tell him I had some to go pick up a child from daycare. He's like, "You want to bring her over?" I'm like, "She's a year and a half. No, thank you, sir. You will fire me if she does anything to the Resolute desk." But to have some empathy in the midst of just a lot going on makes it pretty fantastic to have someone like that to work for.
You just heard how the Biden negotiating team feels about their boss, the president of the United States. Next, you'll hear how their boss feels about them.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
You know, I had a minute talking to the president about you, about the three of you. And I now know where the patience comes from, because he expressed such complete confidence in the three of you at every minute of this process. And for his director of OMB, who he, as you say, he's known you the shortest amount of time, just since this presidency, really. He used the word awe. He just is, amazed by you and thrilled by your complete command of everything that you are hoping your OMB director is in command of. And so he absolutely, filled up that minute about you with a praise level that would just thrill everybody you know and you.
Can you read that out to my parents? Well, thank you for letting me know that. I mean, it's when you're in war fighting mode, as these two know, it's sometimes hard to hear nice things about you, especially from your boss, who's the president of the United States. So I'm just glad we were able to do what needed to be done. And we only did that because we got that from him. Failure was not an option here.
And, when the word Ricchetti comes up in a conversation with him, he starts talking about Steve Ricchetti as if he's talking about the greatest athlete he's ever seen over a 30-year period of doing this kind of work in the White House. And he just goes on about Steve, and couldn't do it without you.
Well, this was really the three of us with the president. The reason I think we're effective in this is that we knew where we were supposed to go. We knew what he wanted us to do. That's, I think, the coin of the realm in this is for people to believe who you're negotiating with or who you're talking to or working on to get something done affirmatively, that you're speaking on behalf of the president, that he understands, and you will report fairly and accurately to him the other side of the equation. And we take great pride in being able to do that way and to do our work that way. And it's really, again, at his direction. And so it's been an honor. I've been with him almost 12 years now. It's been an honor every single day to be in these roles with him. And I can say all three of us are enormously or have enormous pride about everything we've been able to accomplish legislatively over the last 2.5 years, including this work, because I think the progress has been historic and it will be long lasting. I think it's really a durable strategy to help both invest in the country and to secure our economic future.
And Louisa, when he talks about you and the president talks about you, he gets emotional very quickly, very quickly, because immediately he's going all the way back to kindergarten.
It's been a long time. I feel very, it's a pleasure and a privilege to have your boss, but also be someone that you've looked up to your whole life and known and been in their house and see expressions that you're like, wait, Bo's, like, they have the same expressions sometimes. And but it is, I tell them I feel lucky every moment that I get to walk in the door here and to have such a long and deep relationship with someone that I admire so very much.
It's truly lucky. So you're a kid in kindergarten in Delaware, and the parents, the father of your classmate, Bo Biden, is a United States senator. At what grade do you comprehend this?
Right. It did take a little while. That is a very accurate. I mean, you know, kids. So I always joke to him that he was one of the first people in maybe Delaware to have like a fax machine. And it was in the living room. And the whole thing was like, do not touch, break, breathe on the fax machine as we were running around. And so I would say it was not really until maybe middle school where you realize it and we start doing the school trips, but that were special school trips to Washington, D.C. because we were with Bo's dad. So, but it definitely took a little while. For a while, he was just my friend's dad.
Well, I've never known a bond like this between a president and someone working in the White House. And it's the very first thing he talks about when he talks about you.
It's very special. I feel very lucky.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. The Biden negotiating team of Shalonda Young, Steve Ricchetti, and Louisa Terrell get tonight's last word.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.